This Wednesday, Tuesday, I went to our Tucson clergy cluster, which sounds kind of funny. It sounds like a little group of candies. Tucson clergy, well, I've gathered with that group for 12 years. And, you know, about for the first 5 years, we were pretty stiff with each other. And we just talked about all the good things that were going on in our ministry. Well, we brought in this much money for our pledge drive. Well, we have 42 kids in our program. You know, that kind of stuff, that kind of boasting. We didn't dare show each other how our hearts had been broken with this call that we have to serve. We didn't dare to talk to each other about what we'd done that was a mistake, what had gone wrong, and somebody had left the church or been angry with us. We kept those things secret. And then a new person came, a stranger to our group, and suggested that we do a check-in, and rather than what we'd always done, kind of go down the list of shiny things, we would say, pow, how, and wow. Pow was what hurt, what wounded us or wounded other people, what wasn't working. Wow was what's great in our ministry and in our lives, and how was our relationship with God. Now, you'd be surprised, but ministers don't talk to each other very much about our relationships with God. Because we talk about that all the time, and because sometimes we're stuck. Sometimes we don't really have a word to share. Sometimes we're exhausted. Sometimes we're tired. Sometimes we want to laugh when we shouldn't laugh. You know, there's all these things that happen. But something opened up in our group, and we began to draw in close. And now, after 6 or 7 years of that practice, we really look forward to these times. And we do that practice before we do our Bible study, which really enlivens the word on the page through the word in our lives. This Tuesday, Jim Briney, who is going to retire in 2018, he and his wife are moving from a big space to a smaller space. And Sandra is an incredible textile artist. And she makes, among other things, stoles. She weaves them. She paints them. And we were invited to the Briney's home, where we got to look around and see what they had that we might want to have dibs on for later, you know, as they started to get rid of things. But also, she said that she had made a stole and she wanted us to each have one. And so, you know me, I love stoles. I tell stories with stoles, and they also, you know, go with what I have on. So I'm always, and I love to have stoles that are made by people, so I was really excited. So we went, and she opened up, she unzipped this carrier, and it had like 30 stoles in it. Oh my gosh, we poured over them. It was like, oh my gosh, they were so beautiful, and we had to pick one that was going to be so hard, and what color was it going to be, and what was it? I mean, fabulous. She sells her stoles for $300 to $1,000 each. Right. So she wasn't selling us these. So we each picked one, and we were like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. And she said, well, you know, pick another one. So we were like, oh my gosh. So we picked another one, right? And then she said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with these stoles, so pick another one. And I said, well, clearly gluttony is not a sin in this house. So we all got three stoles. So I'm wearing one today. Isn't this incredible? It's not woven, but it's hand-painted silk on both sides and made by Sandra Briney. And I was so grateful, but I thought it was also lovely of how life weaves into the gospel for the week. And so we have a story today of fishes and loaves, and we often think of that story as about God's abundance in times that are difficult, and God is there for us, and this miracle, and we don't have enough, but suddenly there's enough for our table. And so I thought, that's exactly the experience I had with this stole. You know, there weren't enough stoles for me, and we were asked to choose three. That was so exciting. This is the only miracle story we have of Jesus that appears in all four of our Gospels. So it's a very important story. But I think that we focus perhaps on only one thing of a text that's really rich in lessons. So while I think it is about the feast to which we're all invited, that is bountiful beyond our wildest imagination, It's also about some other things that I want to draw your attention to. There's differences in all four Gospels depending on the Gospel writer and the community that it was written for. And so the story is meant for that particular community, this one for the Matthew community. And so it has a tone of the conflict between empire and Jesus's ministry. In John's Gospel, Jesus is the only one who serves. Jesus has the food, and Jesus is the only one that serves, which is a different theology when we come to church. If we think that Jesus is the only one that can do that, we probably can't do that, right? But in Matthew's Gospel, it's not just Jesus. In fact, Jesus disputes what the disciples have said and says, "You got some food in your backpacks. I can tell by how fat they are. How about you take it out and we'll pass it around?" And they're like, "What? We don't have any food." You know, how many times has that happened to you where there's been the NPR commercials, right? You know, it's time to give and you should give, and you know, you listen to it all the time and you turn the radio off because you really don't want to hear that, and then you hear it again, right? You've got money in your pocket, but it really takes some cajoling to get it out of your pocket, and maybe, oh, you just give. I haven't given for 3 years, so I'm going to give, right? Well, that's what the disciples were feeling too. Let those people go and find their own food. But they were in a deserted place and it was getting dark. So where were they going to go to find food? And these weren't people. These were people who were suffering, who were made poor, who were sick, who were disabled. There were crying children, and there were women who were there wondering what in the world they were going to feed their children, because they'd followed Jesus while he was in a boat. They'd walked along a path trying to follow him, and they were waiting there for him. They weren't going to be able to go and buy food like the disciples said. Jesus not only invited them to the feast, but he would not dismiss them. He would not send them away and say, "I'm sorry, healthcare is only for a few people, not for you. I'm sorry, this table is only for a few people, not for you. This table, God's table, whatever is on it, and this place are holy and are made for all God's people." It wasn't just that they were fed as much as they wanted and more. They were sated in a time when there was never enough food. But they were not dismissed. Think about that today. Who's dismissed? Who's dismissed in our own congregation? Whose voice doesn't get heard? Who says something and people go on as if that person didn't talk? Who says something and someone else says what they said as if that person had never said it and carries it forward? I see people going, "Oh, who's not here to speak up for themselves?" Right? We have an interesting story of two dinner parties. The beginning of chapter 14 in Matthew's Gospel opens with an ominous tone. What we don't hear is that Herod Antipas, who's the first century ruler of Galilee and author of the Massacre of Innocents when Jesus was a child, Herod Antipas threw a lavish birthday party for himself in which his daughter Salome danced for him and his guests. You can imagine this lavish display of wealth, and only a few people were privileged to be there to feast, to gorge themselves, to drink, and have this beautiful woman dance for them. So tantalized was he by Salome, by her beauty, that he swore an oath in front of his guests and promised to do anything she wanted. Have we heard that story somewhere before? Of empires lost, or companies that went down the tube, or churches by people who were so besotted by someone that they risked everything for it. She told him that she wanted John the Baptist's head on a platter. She was carrying out the revenge of her mother, Herodias, who was angry because John the Baptist had criticized her for marrying Herod. She was his niece, and that wasn't legal. Herod's pride rendered him unable to back down from his promise, and so he carried it out and had John beheaded in prison. At Herod's birthday party, a head was presented on a platter, John's. John's disciples went and got the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. We can only imagine his grief over his cousin's horrific execution. We can also imagine that he was acutely aware that he might be next. If Herod would order the massacre of innocents, if Herod would behead John the Baptist on a whim, then Herod would not stop his violence against people who followed God's good news. Our text tells us that the word spread. In the story about Herod, the word spread, and Herod responded to that word of John the Baptist's threat by feeling frightened and threatened. So he had an edge before he was even asked to present her head on a platter, right? That word, which could have been good news to Herod, was not. It was turned and twisted and became bad news. The crowds heard the word made flesh, Jesus. They heard about what Jesus was doing and they followed him. Huge crowd, the text tells us this morning, was following Jesus as he's in his little boat. This huge crowd is walking, I mean, it's kind of comical to think about, was walking along the path waiting for him to disembark so he could continue to teach and heal and accompany them. The word spreading looks different in different communities. One is converted to violence and revenge, to greed, to avarice, to intolerance. And the other is good news for everyone. The other brings food to people who are hungry and something to drink for people who are thirsty, as the prophet Isaiah says. Jesus saw this vast throng, and our story tells us that his heart broke for them, and he went to work attending to their suffering. And that happens to us too, doesn't it? We can hear these stories, but when we go to the border or we go to up to the church up the street and we see the migrants who have traveled through Mexico, when we go and feed the homeless and we see those people, our hearts are broken. And we're not the same because of it. Somebody was telling me the other day when we had a meeting with some of the UCC folks about our annual meeting that he'd gone down on the desert with 20 people in the Lay Academy's day trip. And he said it was a life changer for those 20 people. When we see and experience the word among us, when we see these acts of courage and commitment and compassion carried out, we want to do the same. The second dinner party is in sharp contrast. It takes place in a surprising place, not in a palace. It was a deserted place and it was getting dark. It was a place where there were ominous overtones. There wasn't enough to go around. They didn't have anything to sleep on. It was a mass of people who were hungry and sick and tired. What could possibly happen there? We have this description of deep grief, and think about what's happening in the world today. My gosh, we get up in the morning and we read the paper and that grief slams into us as soon as we open it up. As soon as we turn on the news, as soon as we see somebody who says, oh, did you hear what happened this week? As soon as we learn how our Congress has voted or not voted, grief changes us. It shrinks us. And that was a place where this particular dinner party took place. Jesus saw it. He recognized it and he acted to change it. The disciples said, send these people away. And Jesus said, no, open your backpacks and share what you have. What would happen today if in the taking up of the offering, I said, open up your wallets and give all your dollars. You know, would people do that, knowing that the money went for a good cause, that you were participating in the good news for all God's people by doing that? Jesus uses this as a teaching moment for the disciples and for us. The 12 have to distribute their own food. They might not even get any. Do you notice that pastors take communion last in the United Church of Christ? This is why. And they have to clean it up. Yesterday at Craig Sales' birthday party, I was vacuuming. And somebody said to me, I don't think you should have to vacuum. You're the pastor. And I said, it's in my job description. Which it is. We're all called to clean up. That's part of our work. What we have in today's story is a continuation of the creation scene from Genesis, about the one who's able to feed all these people out of a few fish sandwiches. Just as creation began with a word, Jesus blesses and breaks what's there and multiplies it to meet the needs of the people. Food is created, the multitude is fed in the abundance, no exceptions. And they can get up and go on to their next right step. Did this story really happen? Or has it, like all good stories, been embellished in the telling? But each of us here could tell a story of fishes and loaves and finding ourselves with people and in a place where our whole self is welcome, and so we know it to be true. Today's lesson is about food, the inalienable right of all God's people to food and health care. And it's also about not participating in a culture in which people made poor and suffering are sent away, out of sight and out of mind. It's about the commitment to witness suffering and not turn away to our own private boardrooms and barrooms and country clubs and golf resorts. Sound familiar? The text echoes two major issues today: radical welcome and health care. Debate in the U.S. is based on the principle of whether one views healthcare as a right or a privilege that only a few can achieve. Healthcare system is how we care for the crowds around us today. Are there adequate resources allocated so that everyone has the basic healthcare that they need? Does our system meet the needs of most, if not all, in our country, and not just card-carrying citizens? Our text advocates for a system more akin to the kingdom of heaven than Herod's court, where the heads of the vast majority are served up on platters to the few who control access to the table. And still, we have a need to feed the hungry. It's amazing with all the excess food we have. 1 out of 9 people in the world today is hungry, literally hungry. 5,000 families in the story today are fed. Herod's meal, his dinner party, is a place of death and destruction and deceit. How does Herod use his power versus how Jesus uses his? What does a meal signify at Herod's dinner party, and what does it mean at Jesus's? Who's invited to the table of Herod's party and to Jesus' party? To be the guy who feeds 10,000 hungry, jobless, disabled, driven crazy, dislocated from their land people to their fill in the desolate place is a dangerous thing. You can understand the magnetic attraction that Jesus' ministry would have and the threat that it was to the authorities. Father Conrado, the priest that was here last week, my good friend, reminded me of a song that we sang together in Soyatitlan in Chiapas. It says, Es Jesus este pan de igualdad. Venimos a conmugar con la lucha del pueblo que busca justicia y dignidad. Conmugar es volverse un peligro. Venimos a incomodar. Con la fe y compromiso su reino va a llegar. The bread of equality is Jesus. We come to the communion table with people who struggle, who look for justice and dignity. To take communion is dangerous. We come to be made uncomfortable with the faith and commitment that God's kingdom will come. It is at great risk that Jesus attends to the physical and emotional and spiritual needs of the people, people who were not welcome in Herod's court and are not welcome in the courts today, people who were as exhausted and worn thin as Jesus was and were given rest with him. Through his actions, Jesus gave a glimpse into the kingdom of God, where everyone is treated with dignity and has their physical and spiritual and emotional needs met. I want you to think for just a moment about the one or ones inside of you who you've dismissed, the one who doesn't get to come to church with you, the one who's not approved by you or by others, and so you're afraid to bring him or her or them to church, the one who cowers in a corner and only comes out where you're really stricken by fear or loss, the one who's always there, you always feel that presence, the one who needs your attention so badly. What would it be if you didn't dismiss your inner selves that weren't imperfect, that weren't perfect? I got that backwards, I think. What would it be if you welcomed your imperfect self to the table? How would you be different? And how would we be different as church? I think we do that here at Rincon. I think we fess up to what's going on and we talk about our brokenness as we celebrate the gifts that we have. But there's always more room for that. And I can see in your faces that there are those places. And me too, there are those places. There are people within me that don't get to come to church. Yeah. And think too about our church. Who is it that is not allowed here, or who just doesn't show up because they think they're not going to be allowed here? Who is it that doesn't have a voice or a vote? How do we listen and make sure not just that the minority here, but the ones that have been chosen to be persecuted, labeled stranger? How is it? Where are they? And how is it that we invite them here? How do we make God's radical inclusion and embrace of all people more evident in what we do and what we say and how we leave Sunday's worship and go into our world to live our lives? Amen.